BBC Radio 4 Extra.
And finally for this hour, Sir Max Hastings concludes his recollections of his journalist parents, MacDonald Hastings and Anne Scott James. In part five of Did You Really Shoot the Television? There's more trouble for Mac and Anne's later business with the small Picasso.
At the age of 14 in 1960, I responded to news that my father was departing to have himself cast away on an uninhabited desert island in the Indian Ocean, much as Superman's son, had he possessed one, would have received news that Dad was off for another bout with Lex Luthor. To me, a triumphant outcome of Father's adventure never seemed in doubt. But my faith was quite ill-founded. He'd done nothing before embarking to learn some useful botany or to make himself fit. Indeed, until the moment he stepped ashore, he sustained his lifelong regime of 50 cigarettes and the best part of a bottle of gin a day. After 5 weeks on the island, he'd lost 32 pounds, his legs were covered in jungle ulcers, and he was displaying early symptoms of scurvy. Only Mac at his maddest could have devised and executed a journalistic stunt which rendered him, quite literally, a stretcher case, and from which his health never entirely recovered. 45 years later, a senior executive of the Daily Mail telephoned me, "We've just had a marvellous idea. You must go and relive your father's desert island adventure." I said, "Not a chance." A few months after Father's return from the island, Mother gave him his marching orders. I was stunned by my parents' parting. Reading in newspapers at school, brief paragraphs announcing the rift in the Hastings household. I threw in my lot with Father, and over the next 30 years there were long periods when my mother and I scarcely spoke or saw each other, largely by my choice. Frustrated and miserable, I enlisted Father's help to get me a holiday job. His name was still affectionately remembered at Lyons, and I was admitted to the company's Olympia sales team, hawking chalk ices and lollies at Bertram Mills Circus and assorted exhibitions such as The Ideal Home. Those were the happiest interludes in an unhappy time. When there was no work for me, I spent holidays in Father's rented cottage near Winchester. In maudlin moments, he offered me two pieces of counsel, one enlightened, the other not. First, he urged me to learn to respond to
the challenge of a blank sheet of paper.
At the time, the phrase meant nothing. Later, when I became a professional writer, it came to seem everything. Second, Father advised me gravely to marry a girl with fat legs
because they are better in bed.
At that time, I'd had no opportunity to explore the truth of this proposition with girls with either thin or fat legs. After 18 torrid, alcoholic months in the wilderness, Mac was rescued by the widow of his publisher, Michael Joseph. He and Anthea were married, and at erratic intervals, I moved into her house in the village of Old Basing near Basingstoke. Anthea was astonishingly restrained in her complaints about my excesses, emptying cigarette boxes, injuring cars, eating extravagant quantities of food, and bringing home conspicuously unsuitable girlfriends. My mother, meanwhile, had formed a relationship with Osbert Lancaster, the artist best known for his pocket cartoons on the front page of the Daily Express. Physically, it was an implausible pairing. Anne towered above the world, dwarfing her new man, who was notably short. To a remarkable degree, from the age of 16 onwards, I lived my own life, and indeed at 17 I moved into a rented flat in Holland Park. In the years thereafter, my chronically restless existence would have commanded the respect of the Flying Dutchman. Relations with Mother did not improve when she told me, at 21, that she just made a new will, leaving everything to my sister. Her judgment was entirely rational, and my father omitted Claire from his will. But I've always regretted that she thought it necessary to tell me what she'd done. Mother later came to see me, urging that I should withdraw my name as a candidate for the Beefsteak Club, which then seemed to represent the summit of glamour and august company.
It's a typical nonsense of your father's to organise this. Osbert's a member, and it'll be too embarrassing for him to have to meet you there.
I joined the Beefsteak anyway. A few years later, Mother wrote to her old friend Charles Winter, then my boss at the Evening Standard, urging him to make me an executive rather than allow me to continue a career as a war correspondent, which he thought likely to get me killed.
He is not good with people. Nobody knows it better than I. But most of the good executives I know in Fleet Street have been bastards.
I knew nothing of those remarks for 30 years after they were written. Reading them in middle age, when I became editor of the Evening Standard and found myself in possession of my predecessor's correspondence, I felt unsure whether to be touched by Mother's anxiety for my survival or mortified by her brutal assessment of my character. She was correct, though I wish she hadn't said it in writing, to assert that I lacked any gift for getting along with people. My late teens and early 20s were a lonely period, full of more anger and frustration than most adolescents inflict upon themselves. In the eyes of the world, I was a prime specimen of what Victorian novelists called a hobbledehoy. I was rescued from delinquency by work. In 1963, Father's influence at Lime Grove Studios narrowly assisted me to a gap-year job in the gift of Alistair Milne as a researcher on a huge project which BBC TV was then launching, the Great War series. There came a moment when I chanced to meet Mac amid the throng at the bar of the BBC Club. After we'd exchanged greetings, he murmured,
"My boy, I think the moment has come at which you should stop calling me Daddy and address me as Father."
It was a significant rite of passage. I took 2 days off from work to sit the Oxford entrance exam, and was surprised and not altogether pleased to be rewarded with an exhibition to University College. I found Oxford no more congenial than had my mother 30 years earlier. Nobody seemed to appreciate me, and I gave them no reason to do so. And having started to earn a living wage, I hated becoming a broke student again. At the end of my first year, Charles Winter offered me a staff job at the Standard. Here was confidence in the possibility that I might have a future outside a reformatory, for which I shall remain grateful to Charles for the rest of my life. Ignoring protests from family and tutors, I quit my college, thus following my great-great-grandfather, grandfather and mother in a family tradition of entering universities and then failing to graduate from them. As Mac's career flagged, most of Anne's time and energy were devoted to a new writing career. She'd been invited to contribute a monthly gardening column to Queen magazine. The feature flourished and led to a series of books which gave her a new reputation. She also became a panellist on the BBC's hugely popular radio quiz show My Word, alongside Dennis Pohl, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden. To the end of her life, her capacity to make Claire and me quail remained undiminished. One day when Mother was in her late 80s, I told her that I entirely respected her decision, declared 30 years earlier, that she would leave her entire estate to my sister, but I added that I'd love to have one of her good pictures. She said nothing, and I went home knowing it would be foolish to cherish expectations. A year or two later, however, she telephoned. "You know how much you've always liked the Picasso." Yes, indeed, this was a coloured drawing of a woman bequeathed to her by a close friend, which always seemed to me and to others rather wonderful. Would you like to buy it? I told my wife Penny, if I go round there and kill her, I shall plead extreme provocation, and no jury will convict. After Mac's marriage to Anthea, he scarcely shot or fished again. Partly, this reflected the fact that he'd lost the desire to kill things. Partly also, the reality that there was no spare money to pay for grouse or pheasant shooting or salmon fishing. Nonetheless, I was able to share with him one last wonderfully happy sporting experience. In 1970, I was 24 and a reporter for the BBC's 24 Hours programme. From Saigon, where I was working, I wrote to the agent Stratton Parker, asking whether they had any Scottish lodges available for rent. God help me, I was starting to tiptoe down Father's path towards fulfilling fantasies at the cost of financial ruin. Struts sent back particulars of several places, of which I fixed on one named the House of Tongue, on the north coast of Sutherland, possessed of 35,000 acres of hill and heather. I arranged to take it for a fortnight in September and persuaded some friends to come with me and share the cost. I also invited Mac. As we sat in the restaurant car, when sleepers possess such splendid relics of fading grandeur, Father held us entranced with tales of the Highlands, some perhaps founded in reality. He was physically 15 years more frail than he should have been at the age of 61, but all his old enthusiasm was restored, together with his genius for imbuing a new experience with a sense of adventure. At Inverness next morning, I'd arranged to rent two Land Rovers, in which we drove north towards the farther remotenesses of Britain. As we topped the hill overlooking the estuary of Tongue, my hopes soared. They were dashed on descending to the shore. The only big house we could see was an undistinguished brick construction. Had I brought a dozen friends here to share a dump? I knocked on the door. The man who responded explained that this was the youth hostel. The House of Tongue, he pointed, around the turn of the estuary. A few hundred yards along the coast, set on the shoreline encircled by trees, was a rambling 17th-century stone mansion. I ran inside through room after room carpeted in tartans, beautifully furnished in the period manner. Each window commanded a perfect view. "You're very lucky, my boy," said Father. "I was laird for a fortnight of the sort of paradise both of us had dreamed of all our lives. We climbed the great heather hills, shot pigeons, fish mackerel, struggled to catch salmon in the nearby river, on which we had a beat. Day after day, the fish defied our best efforts with a fly, and even with worms. Then, one morning on a pretty pool named the Shepherd's, Father tempted a salmon to his fly, played and landed it. Glowing with pleasure, clad in his usual impeccable plus fours and brogues, he held it aloft for a photograph. It was the last fish he ever caught. I bottled that enchanted moment with him, laid it lovingly in the cellar of memories, and have cherished it ever since.
Sir Max Hastings reading the final part of Did You Really Shoot the Television? With Nigel Hastings as Mac and Joanna Munro as Anne. It was abridged by Penny Lester and produced by Duncan Minchell. And all next week at this time, we'll learn of the brief but eventful life of the great composer Frédéric Chopin in Adam Zamoyski's biography, Chopin, Prince of the Romantics.